14, I'm alcoholic.
14.
I've never done this, start backwards on speaking at a meeting, but I'm going to start backwards today. You know, in sobriety, we're going to have some major decisions that we have to make, little, big, medium-sized decisions, and a lot of decisions, it seems, come in the early sobriety. Like we talk about people, places, and things, you know, that if we want to stay sober, we have to change some of these things. And my sobriety date's June the 5th, 1988, 21 years now. And for 21 years, up until Saturday night, I had never sat at a bar with somebody drinking. And I'm on a dating service now. And what I put down was, I'm a non-drinker. I prefer a non-drinker, but an occasional social drinker would probably be all right. So this is what I write in my profile. So I meet up with this guy. We go to Cody's. He wants his little cocktails. I think, you know, fine. So there's no room there. So we sat at the bar, which, you know, I was like, okay. I was like a big girl. I kept saying, you're a big girl. You can do this, you know. And I got my Coke because he already knew I was in AA, and he was fine with it, and you can have your Coke. Well, he got a huge... It was a Cody's. He got a huge beer, and he got halfway through that, and he got a huge Long Island iced tea, which I didn't even know what it was. It's been so long since I drank, you know. People had explained that to me. It's like all booze. And then he had a little mudslider, and then he came home to my couch and passed out. And so I'm, like, re-evaluating my profile. I really have to give my sponsor make a firm decision. Do I want somebody drinking in my life, or do I completely want to have this out of my life? So, you know, it's very interesting here at my age to come across these dilemmas. But I wanted to tell you a little bit about my childhood, because it's so that those formative years are so important. And I was pretty much a little nutcase when I was little. I was very, very rebellious. And one of the things I did in my rebellion, I know I was in the hospital once for a very serious, serious accident I was in. And the little boy across the bed, you know, we had these big marble floors back then, real tall beds with rails. And he dared me to eat those big fat crayons. Well, I ate about three of them, paper and all, and I threw up and all over the floor. And my mother was a nurse in the hospital, and she like beat my butt, you know, and you know, no more eating crayons. Well, then the same kid, I dropped my comic book, and he enticed me and dared me to pick up that comic book, and I was upside down. I can remember I'm upside down and feet up in the air and hands down, and I can remember falling, and I had a severe concussion, woke up with doctors all around me, my parents around me, my dad's threatening to beat my butt again, and I was just a little terror. Also, when I was about in the second grade, you know, I was a farm girl. I grew up on the farm, and Dad would tell you about poison ivy and snakes and bugs and spiders, and you know, we learned about all this. You know, don't get in the pen with a mother sow with babies, she's going to eat you. And so, you know, we learned some real basics in life early. So second grade, I got mad at my mom and dad, and they were both in cahoots on this, in agreement, and I was so furious. I went down to the nearby bridge. Daddy had pointed out the poison ivy. I took all my clothes off, and I rubbed the poison ivy all over me. And I can remember saying, I'll show you. Well, I was completely, completely poison ivied. I mean, they had to put me in a tub of calamine lotion and just soak me, and my fingers were all swollen shut, and my eyes were all swollen shut, and I can remember going back to second grade, and I still couldn't get my fingers apart very good and trying to write. But, you know, I look back at that behavior, and, you know, something's wrong with that picture. So anyway, the other thing, I grew up in a violent home. I had a home that was very, lots of mixed messages. It was one of the best homes. We did have a lot of fun. But just briefly, so you understand, my parents have grown spiritually through the years. There were times when I wished my dad dead. I didn't care if I ever saw him again. I meant that with all my heart. And there's a reason. I mean, they got started off on the wrong foot. My mother was illegitimate back in the 20s or early 30s, and in a very small town. That got off to a rocky start. She was raised by my great-grandfather. And then my father lost both his parents at 42 years old, and he went to the orphanage with the children during the Great Depression. And these children went through hell in that orphanage. And then he lied and he went to the World War II at 16. And when he came out, he had an earring, tattoos, and an Indian. And, the motorcycle Indian. And he was angry. He was very, very angry. And he proceeded to be angry. And matter of fact, I think he's still angry at 85 years old. But there were things that happened in our childhood that children shouldn't have to go through. My childhood was really ripped away from me. We were belittled. I thought my brother's names were a little, I can't say it right now, but he had a little cuss words for him, you know, and I thought their name was that until I was like 10 and I finally realized that my brothers had names. My dad abused me sexually, and I don't usually say that in meetings, but I feel like in a young people's meeting, you know, you're so close to that growing up years that some of you are struggling with this, and not just the girls, you know, the boys as well, and I mentioned this last time I spoke here. All I can say is there's life after abuse. And one of the things that happened to me when I came into sobriety, I not only dealt with the flat tires and the broken toothbrush and the little things in life that irritate you, the broken hangnail and fingernail, but I dealt with the really hard stuff. And I had a moderation or mediation with my family before I came into AA, and after that I got more suicidal. I suffered with suicide my whole life from the time I was about 11 years old and on. So I didn't have my first drink till I was 18 years old. I went to a college. One of the girlfriends from my hometown invited me to a sorority party, and it was at a fraternity party. I guess they get together like that often. I was a little poor girl from Indiana, and you know, my clothes showed it. You know, I was there with kids of means, and it was back in the 60s, and they all got their mattresses downstairs in the basement with black lights, and the huge room, half the size, and there were just wall-to-wall people doing stuff. I was the last woman standing, and this man was standing beside me. He was a couple years older. I thought he was a grown man, and he had a suit on and a tie, and I thought, now he must be the president. And I wasn't about to get on one of those mattresses. So he said, he took a flask out of his pocket, and I really didn't know what it was. You know, he took a big drink, and he handed it to me, and he says, here, do you want a drink? And I said, well, I guess so. And I didn't ask him what it was or anything, and I took a big swig, and this is the God's truth. When that warm vodka hit my toes and went and it came back up, I thought I had jet fuel in my veins. I'd never felt anything so awesome on my entire life. And he had to fight me for the flask after that. So anyway, that was my first drink. And that was in February of my senior year. And between February and the end of May when I graduated, I had gotten all my girlfriends fake IDs, and I took them from Indiana across the state line to Ohio to drink with me. I thought drinking was the best thing that anybody ever invented. I just thought everybody should know about this. And so one by one, my girlfriends, their parents said, "You can't be with her anymore. You know, this is not good." And so one by one, I lost my girlfriends here in my senior year when it was so important. And I went across the state line every time I could. I only lived 7 miles away, so it wasn't a big deal. But to drink, because in Ohio, you could drink a 3-2 beer, you know, if you were, I don't know how old you had to be, 18, I guess. But it wasn't good. What happened with this alcohol thing, it set off a craving that I could not stop. And I had gotten two full scholarships. I could go to Indiana University or pick Miami of Ohio. And I picked Miami of Ohio. And that's where I went drinking, when I went across the state line to Miami of Ohio. So I knew all the bars. I knew half the people in town, the townies. And I'd go and dance and carry on. It was great stuff. So when I started college, and literally I didn't have to pay a dime, I couldn't stop drinking. And I would go up to the north end of town where I worked and helped my aunt and uncle. They had a dry cleaning place, and I'd go bar to bar on the way back to the dorm. And, you know, half the time I'd get back at 10 o'clock at night, you know, and I'd try to study all during the night. It was just a real bad scene. And I lost, actually I get kicked out of school, but I won't go into that. I get kicked out for drinking and lying, actually. But at the end of that semester, and there went that scholarship. And, you know, in our steps, some of you are new here, but there's a step 9 where we make direct amends to those that we have hurt. And when I say decisions, like this guy with the drinking deal, there are other things that come to mind. It doesn't matter how long you're here, how many years of sobriety, there's always work to be done. And this year, I was sitting in a meeting with a group of friends. It's kind of a private little book study on Sundays. And it came to me that I needed to make amends to that attorney that helped me get that full scholarship to go to Miami of Ohio. I took money from a fund, a trust fund, that could have been used for other men and ladies, and I wasted it. And I have an amends to make. And, you know, I've been in a long time, and what happened about 3 months ago, I heard people in this group talking about their amends, and I thought, you know, I never made that many amends, and something's wrong with me. I said, "God, there's got to be more amends inside of me. I just don't feel comfortable. I feel like there's something I need to deal with." And I prayed about it for a whole week, and nothing came. And I kept saying, "I know there are things inside of me that are bothering me, and I need to make amends for." Well, look out. Look for what you pray for. God started showing me so many things that I had never made amends for. And some of them were really, really difficult. Some of them had to do with my family. So, you know, we're never too old to learn and to grow in AA. And I love our little saying, you never have to be bored in AA, because there's always, always, always something to do. Now, when I came into AA, I had had a good job. I worked here in Tampa. I lived here in Tampa for the post office. And I was in a special department, and I was in, I handled the mail, and I was in this booth, and I was also on a lot of pills back then. I'd had a couple bad car wrecks, so I was on pills and alcohol, and the room was spinning. I was in terrible shape. The room was spinning, and I was having DTs and hallucinations, and I saw my head spinning, 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 and my blood plastered all over these walls. It was a big, big warehouse like this. And I was shaken, and I thought there were bugs, spiders, and snakes in all those white tubs where you see mail. Most of you have probably seen those tubs. And I was sweating. I was soaking wet. And one of the supervisors came up to me and said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I don't know." But I said, "I'm going home, and I'm not coming back till I get better." And at that moment in time, I honestly didn't know what was wrong. You know, I was taking pills that it took me 9 months to detox off of. You know, I took pills every half hour, whether I needed it or not. It was like I was on a drip IV. And trying to put booze on top of that, it was just a miracle that I did not kill myself. And at that point in time, the doctors were checking my liver every week. But you know, that doctor that checked my liver, he never looked me in the eyes and said, "You know, I think you may be drinking too much, or I think you may be abusing pills, or something's going on with you." Never once did he look me in the eye and say that. And so what I try to tell my sponsees, I try to tell people in AA, that nobody cares about your sobriety like you. Nobody cares about my sobriety like I do. I am totally responsible for staying clean and sober on a daily basis. You can go to doctors and they'll give you about anything you want if you've got the biggest pity party, you know. And I had three doctors going, just in case one of them slipped up. So what happened, I ended up in the mental hospital right before I came into AA. I'd been in several. So I can relate to little Nikki. Where are you? Can relate. And I can remember calling my dad from the mental hospital, the first one, and saying, "Dad, these people are really crazy." And he's saying, "Honey, you're there too, you know." So anyway, here we are in the locked up ward, and I got in a fight with my doctor. I had such attitude. I didn't get along with anybody. I'd go into 7-Eleven and get a fight with the cashier. I mean, I just fought with everybody, and I always had to have the last word. And so I had to have the last word with the doctor, but I lost, and he threw me out of the nut ward. And I got up to the front desk, and I was hoping the nurses would, like, you know, have pity on me and tell the doctor, "Oh, she needs to stay." And they're going like this, out. And I mean, I had thrown the preacher out of the nut ward. He'd come to visit me and called the church and said, "Don't ever let that so-and-so come to see me again." I mean, I was really off the chain. So I get home, and my boss calls. And the post office was the best job for me in the whole world. I loved it. And I could buy my girls dance lessons and give them things that I never had. I have two daughters. And right now, the baby's 32 and the older one just turned 40. So, but back then, I had these two daughters, and all I wanted was a good life for them. So that job meant so much. And she called me up and said, "Look, I just came to visit you, and you're not in the hospital." She says, "If you're not there, when are you coming back to work?" And I said, I had the telephone. I said, "I've got a drug and alcohol problem, and nobody's helping me." And my moment of clarity. Remember when I was in that booth at the post office with the bugs and spiders and all that? I hadn't a clue what was wrong with me. And that moment, it just came rolling out. And she says, "Stay by the phone. I'll have somebody call you." So she had the EAP counselor call me, and I said, "You know, I'm going to an AA meeting right today. I'm going to an AA meeting." And I called my brother. He's 3 years ahead of me in sobriety. And Brother Dan said, "Well, sis, you always feel better when you go to those meetings with me." He said, "Why don't you just go and listen? Maybe they'll say something to make you feel better." I said, "Okay," because I was crazy. I knew I was crazy. I really didn't think I was alcoholic. So I went to that first meeting, and I was very upset. 33-33, it looked like a little hellhole. Nicotine on the walls, little red ashtrays, you know, it stunk, and pretty scary characters, some of them. And I sat next to this guy. His name is Flip Flop John. And Flip Flop John just loved to sit by me. We used to call him Janitor John, too, because he got a job. But Anyway, he was Flip Flop John, and that's because he was up north, and he was in his pajamas, and he'd go to the liquor store, and one day he had his liquor bottle, and he passed out, and he was in the dumpster, and he had his little flip-flops on. So anyway, we called him Flip Flop John. He's still there, and we still remember each other when I go in there once in a while. But he would whisper crazy things to me, and I would sit here like this because I was so embarrassed. I was in an AA meeting. I kept saying, how did a good gal like you get in a place like this? And I know we probably all say that, but I really meant it. And so anyway, little Flip Flop, he would whisper things to me, and he says, we're not soggy, we're foggy. And I would go home, and the girls would ask me, "What, Mom, you're feeling so much better. What are they telling you there?" And I'd say, "Well, Mom's not soggy, she's foggy." And they loved it. You know, they just laughed. They thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. So anyway, I owe my life to the people I met at 3333. I had people that were just dear and precious until my first sponsor passed away when I was 13 years sober, and we were very, very close. But that did save my life. But at the time, you can call me Liz for short, Liz Taylor. I've had quite a few marriages. I'm not going to tell you how many, because then you will stop listening to me. I'll have absolutely no credibility if I tell you that. But anyway, I'm married to a man who was, he always had his bags packed. The 5 years we were together, he always had his bag packed. I married him under the influence. I divorced him sober. But when I chose to get sober, he got absolutely violent and very, completely off the charts angry. And he tried to kill me. He threatened me. He threatened my sponsor. He threatened people that helped me. I had to, I was on the run for 3.5 years. When we finally got, I'd go to the courthouse downtown, I'd have to have two great big deputies with guns bringing me into the courthouse because my life was in danger. It was a nightmare, and I won't go into it too deeply because I start shaking. But again, AA people saved my life. Every time I had to go to court, and I went to court a lot over that, I had an AA person with me. A lot of the big guys would go with me, you know, big guys, and frown at him. But anyway, he ended up on house arrest for trying to kill me and trying to kill another AA person and for three years. And so anyway, it's been a journey. And all I can say is that I think the most important thing in my sobriety is that I found a higher power that works. You know, our book says, find a faith that works. And I had a faith when I got here. I was a little church lady. I was the church lady. I went to church every time the church was open. And the sicker I got, the more I went to church. And the more I went to church, the more I cried. And at the end of my using and going to church with my two girls, Julie, the oldest, was just a horrible child. She was so difficult. She was difficult at 1 year old. She was rebellious. I can't imagine where she got that from. But we would sit on the back two seats of this big church, and I was very involved in drama and all this stuff there. But at the end of my using, I would... we'd sit in the back two pews, Julie be in the back with her tennis shoes on my seat and reading Kurt Vonnegut and just dressed like a little urchin, and because she wouldn't dress up. And then my little one would be clinging to me just crying her eyes out. And I would go down to the altar and I would beg these people to help me. I would beg them. I said, I don't know what's wrong with me. And they said, well, you need to surrender. And I said, how do you do that? And nobody could tell me how to surrender. You know, they I don't know whether they, if they did tell me, it sure didn't soak in. And I suffered. It's like I had a faith. There was a God. I know His Son. I know the Bible in and out. But I did not trust. When my father had damaged me as a young child and I left home, I didn't want any part of church because he would drag us to church and then he'd take us home and beat us. And when I left home, I said, that's it. I don't want anything to do with church. I don't want anything that is titled father. I would not call God father for many, many years. So it was difficult for me to trust. And without trust, there really is no faith that works. You know, the faith that works is trust. Not just belief. I had all the believing that I needed, but I didn't have that trust. I didn't, step three, turn your will over to a God of your understanding. That was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But when I was in these AA meetings and I was shaken from head to toe, I didn't want to use, and I would go home after the meetings and I would watch the clock and I would watch it for a minute. Okay, I'd say anybody can stay sober a minute. Anybody can stay sober for 5 minutes. Anybody can stay sober for 10 minutes. And I just kept going like that in the beginning. And I was so weak from all the drugs that I'd been on that I would just crumble in a pile. My spine couldn't even hold me up. And I know some of you can relate to that. But this faith that works is something that will hold you through those temptations, those heavy decisions that you're going to need to make in your sobriety. You know, there's going to be a time where you're going to have to make a decision. Are you going to stay sober? Are you going to have a better life? Are you going to have peace in your life? I have peace today in my life, and probably a little too much. I like to lay on the couch and read books now, instead of cleaning house. But in the beginning, I was such a nervous wreck. I couldn't hardly sit down for a few minutes, and it took me 3 years of sobriety before I could sit on my couch on my day off and sit still and read a book. I don't know if some of you can relate to that or not. But, you know, I'd be in meetings and I might have to do several different chairs. You know, it was difficult for me to sit still. When I finally found that moment of joy, when I realized I was truly in peace, I called my sponsor up and told her, because I had called her previously, you know, like a year previously, and I said, you know, this AA is boring. And she said, you're getting peace. She said, you just don't know the lack of chaos. She said, that boring is really peace. So I wanted to tell you something, too. I'm bouncing all around tonight. On the way over here, I felt like a fake. I said, I just feel like a fake. I don't want to get up there and talk to these people. I've had a rough week, and I have been nervous all week. And, you know, when you get a certain length of sobriety, you think you should be perfect. And we're kind of hard on each other, you know, as we get a little bit older, you know, in sobriety. I know that nobody's perfect. And thank God our literature says progress, not perfection. You know, I love that. That's what got me sober. That's what keeps me here. But I have had some trials and tribulations this week, so I haven't been on my best game. And I feel like I'm spiritually fit, but, you know, life happens. You know, life happens, and you're going to have times when you're nervous and upset. You know, there are going to be times when you go to bed and cover your head up and cry. But we don't have to live like that. I made a decision when I came into AA. I made a commitment to myself. I said, self, you are not going to get in bed and cover your head up unless you're going to sleep at night. Because I spent literally years and years and years in bed with the blinds pulled, with my bottle, and just not living life. I missed 10 years of my life. I never had a television. I never had a radio. I wouldn't let my children watch TV. I thought those people, those commercials, were invading our privacy and brainwashing us. So, you know, I wouldn't have the TV. You know, I used to pick up the telephone. I didn't even like telephones. The telephones would ring and I'd go, "What do you want?" You know. I was really, really antisocial. So all I can say is it does get better, but without the steps, I would have been back at that crazy neurotic person I came into. And when I was in the first 90 days of sobriety, I heard them say 90 days and, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did that. And at the 90th day, I crossed a path. I couldn't go on staying sober by myself. I didn't know how to go back. I didn't want to go back because I knew I was dying. I was skin and bone, and I actually had three doctors tell me that I wasn't going to live much longer. I wasn't going to live to see my daughters graduate high school and get married. So I did want to change, but after that 90 days, I stood up in a women's meeting, and I hadn't talked to one person for 90 days, not one word except Flip Flop John. I'd listen to him, but I wouldn't talk to him. And I got up in the meeting, and I said, "If this is AA, this sucks." And I said, "If I don't get help by the end of this meeting, I'm out of here." I said, I can't do this anymore. And two of the ladies were co-chairing, and they started laughing and giggling, and I thought, oh, great, they're laughing at me. And they came up after the meeting, and they said, "We've got you. We've got you." And I thought, great. You know, because I didn't trust anybody or anything. You know, I didn't even trust the chairs I sat on. I wouldn't even sit tight in the chair. So they gave me a big book, and they said, "Be at my house at 9 in the morning." So I walked down their little dirt lane. Yes, in Tampa, there are little dirt lanes here and there. And I walked down the little dirt lane with my book under my arm. And we sat down and started reading the big book together. And that's when my sobriety started. When we opened that book together. And then a little bit later, they came to my house, and one of them did the third step prayer with me. And I felt such a burden lifted. But then, did the third step, fourth step, fifth step. I was still pretty miserable. Fourth step was pretty miserable. Got into that fifth step, and my sponsors came into my living room, and they got down on their knees, and we said a prayer together that God would take this garbage off of me. And up until that time, they had invited me to lunches, and I would go to the diners and Papa John's or whatever is still up there, I think. And I would lay my head on the table, and I'd cry through the whole thing. I would cry. I wouldn't eat, couldn't eat in public. I'd lost my ability to swallow and eat in public. And when I did that fifth step prayer, and we went over the fourth step, we went to the diner right afterwards. And I sat up and I ordered a hamburger, french fries, and a Coke, and I laughed with the gang, and I never cried since then. I've never cried since then at diners, you know? It's been great. But the steps are the answer. And I'll tell you, I have fallen in love with AA again this year. I went to Founders Day up in Akron, Ohio. All these years of sobriety, I'd never been up to Founders Day and saw Dr. Bob's house. And I went up there, and these bikers greeted me. And I am not a biker chick. No way, no how. And here they're the first ones that greeted me, and they put their hands out and they said, "Welcome home." And I'm going, "Oh, no, no, I'm from St. Petersburg, Florida." And they said, "No, welcome home." And I looked at Dr. Bob's house and went, "Oh, yeah, I get it," you know. And it was like, I did feel like I was coming home, you know, but it's like a blonde moment, I guess. So anyway, it opened my mind and eyes to the unity of AA, and how without our unity we are nothing, and without our history we are nothing, without the people that came before us we are nothing. And I went to my first conference this year. I've gone to two conferences now, And my late husband was in AA. He had a long-term sobriety, and he had done so many conferences and things in his early sobriety that he really kind of got burnt out on that, and he didn't want to go, so I didn't go. You know, we were like the Bobbsey twins. We went everywhere together. So these have opened my eyes, these conferences, and thank God you people have all this activities that you're doing, and I just so proud of all the young people here. And I just feel like I've bounced all around tonight, and I just hope something made sense. But I thank you, Esther, and everybody for asking me to come over tonight. I really, really do appreciate it. Thank you.